RNN.
For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means.
Connecting the Dots with Dan Happel.
Tonight's featured show is Connecting the Dots with Dan Happel. Welcome.
Thank you, Kelby. I welcome the listeners to our show tonight. We have a guest on by the name of Dennis Young, who is he was the head of the Libertarian Party of Canada, and he also is ex-Canadian Army and military police, and he has a lot of information about the things that have gone on in the Bosnian campaign back in the 90s, and a lot of the history, because while he was a military policeman and was with the Canadian Army in Bosnia, he became involved with some U.S. military operations there and got to see firsthand some of the things that were happening in Bosnia. And he got to know enough of the a quantity of the people there and the situation there that he really got a feel for the politics and all the things that were behind the war in Bosnia. And with that, I want to welcome you, Dennis, to the show. And I would like maybe for you to give our listeners a little bit of a little more information on you and the excellent book that you wrote. I didn't mention that during the discussion, but Dennis has got a book called A Henchman's Honor. I have read the book. It's extremely readable. It's a bit intimidating by the number of pages, but it is extremely readable. And I think, Dennis, we've discovered a new writer in you, and I look forward to the next one that you write. But anyway, would you give our listeners just a little bit more information on your background? And then we'll get into the discussion about the things that you saw in Bosnia.
Sure. First of all, Dan, thanks. And thanks a heap for inviting me on such an excellent show. You have a great show. I've gone and watched a lot of your other stuff, and I'm proud to be here. But so I grew up just north of Montana. You know, I can still drive about 10 hours to get to Bozeman straight south. So I'm a prairie boy with a lot of, I feel at home being in Montana. So we did all the prairie things, like, you know, shooting road signs as we went down the road and throwing beer bottles, that sort of stuff. And then I got into the military and I did the infantry, and I was in a mountain unit in Germany I was over in Germany for 4 years. I was 6 years in the unit. It was a light infantry unit. And then I got out, and 2 years of being a civilian again was enough. So I joined the military police. And what I didn't know is that the military police in Canada has an intelligence arm. So it's military police in whereas Marines guard embassies in the U.S., it's the military police who guard embassies in Canada. And they're also, as embassies are, an extension of intelligence operations. Well, obviously the military police would be part of that. And so I started off small. I started doing surveillance on militant natives who were trying to, we call them militant because they wanted their own land back in a place called Iprawash, Ontario. And we had used it, we kicked them off their land for World War II, filled it full of bombs and unexploded bombs, and then we told them they couldn't have their land back. So by the 90s, they got pretty hot about getting back on their land. And anyway, we ended up, one of the Ontario Provincial Police, which is like a state trooper, he just up and they started murdering. They murdered one guy, shot a kid, beat an old man to death. This is all the police. And so I wasn't there at that day. I'd done 6 weeks of surveillance on the native that they killed. And it was really right out of Waco or Ruby Ridge. I mean, it was the same injustice. So it kind of, you know, as I got that, I gained experience, but I lost confidence in what we are and what we're doing. Then I went on to my next operation was working with Russian and Cuban aircraft. Now, what happened was, and I learned later that this mission was on and on again, off again sort of thing. So what was happening was Cuban and Russian aircraft would fly from Moscow. They would refuel in Shannon, Ireland. Then they would refuel in Gander, Newfoundland, and fly straight down the east coast of the U.S. on their way to Cuba. And they would go off course, and the U.S. would respond. And, you know, that's a very sensitive area intelligence-wise. So they wanted to send CIA up to Gander to start checking for wires, cameras, flight plans, all kinds of things on these aircraft in a surreptitious way. But the Canadian government refused and said, we'll do the operation and we'll report to you. Now, there was these, it's called 770 Communication Research Squadron, which was a joint Canadian-American signals intelligence unit. So any intelligence that I had, and they were monitoring it, and it was straight to an American sailor was picking this up from Gander to Gander. So anyway, we found all kinds of shenanigans there. I found flight plans that, you know, basically went over Norfolk, Virginia, pretty much. We found intercept wires connected. We found massive cameras on the plane. So it was set up for business. They're big cargo planes usually, and some passenger airplanes. So what happened was we reported this to my boss, and I found out that the Canadian government was going to the American government and saying, no, there's nothing. And they didn't realize through some I don't know how the bureaucracy worked, but there was an American sailor who knew every bit of my information and reported straight through his command. So I say in my book, I can just imagine the American bureaucrat sitting there listening to the Canadian lie to him and know very well that he's lying to him. But these mm-hmm. these intelligence things, that I learned a lot about, you know, why the Russian aircraft fly close. It's not to, you know, see if they can bomb Washington or anything like that. What it is to get, and next time you hear of a bear bomber flying close to the U.S., you'll know why. It's to get a reaction. So how does America get the planes up to intercept that bomber? There has to be a series of signals sent from, you know, point A to B to C to D to get the planes up there. And that's what they're looking for. So those big aircraft are loaded with these signals intelligence capabilities, and they get the reaction and they find out, point A of the, or ground zero of them sending up the planes is, I don't know where it was, Colorado maybe. And so they would know that in a war, if they shut down that point, there would be no planes up to intercept them. So they test every once in a while, and they see. It sounds like it's a game of cat and mouse where they move it around a bit, who sends the flights up. I don't know. That was over my pay grade. But that was sort of the game I was in. And I thought it was almost comical.
Well, Dennis, I know that you actually got on the planes while these Cuban and Russian pilots were in the flight lounge, taking a break and having dinner or whatever. And a number of times you and I don't remember the guy's name that you were on there with, but I remember he was a French-Canadian. And you guys would get on the plane and actually find the flight manifests and take some pictures of those. And you actually, if I remember correctly, actually took one of the lenses off one of the cameras on the belly of the plane just to examine the camera underneath, right?
That's right. I actually broke it. I broke this lens.
You broke it,
so
yeah.
Long, like I wanted to tonight. Like they weren't supposed to know we were there. But I was trying to see how long the lens was, so I was reaching way because they had a plexiglass covering the fuselage. So the first time we did it, we didn't have a screwdriver or anything, so we just kind of noted it. But the next time we saw it, we had the screwdriver. We took off the plexiglass that was kind of smooth to the fuselage, and I stuck my hand way up there, and the lens was still going, so I was twisting it and seeing, and I broke it off. And so then there was a panic. Obviously, somebody's going to know somebody. So we put the plexiglass back on. But the way we got out there was kind of the RCMP would put us under a black. So we have like a criminal division for the RCMP. And anyway, there's airport division, and all they do is security at airports. So they would take us in the cruiser, in the back, they cover us up, and roll up to the airplane and guard it while these Russians or Cubans got off to the, it was usually a shell station, actually, the refueler. Mm-hmm. So, we would get, as soon as the Mountie would say, well, it's all clear, they're inside, and we would get off and go do our thing and spend a couple of minutes. We knew how long the plane was supposed to be parked there, and we'd get back and take pictures and do our thing and get back. But I got caught once. If you want to jump to the end of this mission, what happened was I learned at some point well into this that the guy before me, about a year or two before me, had got caught, and they were going to take him to Russia for debriefing. And he was some kind of martial arts expert, and I'm not a martial arts expert. So I had my own and I wasn't allowed to sign out my military pistol to go on the plane. They said no. So I had my own 9mm Beretta, and I carried it on there. And one time I was going through these flight logs. I was, really focused on reading the flight plans and taking pictures and everything. I mean, they teach us everything about F-stops and lighting and everything. And it all kind of goes to, it doesn't work out in the cockpit. Anyway, mm-hmm. I felt a presence behind me, and I looked, and there was the biggest Russian I ever saw standing right. And he's waving his fingers. Like, nyet, 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 nyet. And I'm like, oh, I'm just a reporter here with the local. I know he couldn't understand a word I was saying. But I said, I'm a reporter with a local paper. I was just seeing where you guys were going. And I kept yapping, and I put my hand back on my pistol behind my belt. And I was polite to him, and he filled up the whole entrance to the cockpit. And I just kind of eased towards him to squeeze out, and he let me go. whew. Didn't want to have to get that Beretta talking.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, one of the things that you found out about that, though, was the fact that the Canadian government and the CIA were definitely not playing ball on the same court, and that the Canadian government was telling the U.S. government totally different things than was actually happening. And like you said, the CIA was monitoring through this fishing trawler or whatever, was monitoring all the conversations and the traffic going back and forth. And so, it was not like we were all playing together in the same park.
Well, it was, I think is, first of all, the tradition of communism in Canada is at least 50 years old in a hardcore sense. Trudeau, we have mm-hmm. Trudeau now, that's his son, but his father was a card-carrying communist the entire time he was in government here. So he was batting for the other team all the time. You know, he took our military down to, I think, 60,000 at one point mm. because he saw no reason, and this was the height of the Cold War.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so in our site, in our signals intelligence site there, it's a hard brick-and-mortar site with only 1,000 wires around it. A U.S. sailor would be sitting right beside a Canadian sailor collecting this same stuff. Like, they worked in this. So it was absolutely impossible to BS them. They knew everything mm-hmm. we knew. But when we sent our reports, we sent them through diplomatic channels. And it's like they didn't know what was going on in Gander. They didn't know the structure, and so they attempted to lie about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I know you had mentioned that there was a lady who was in charge of the whole intelligence section right there in Gander, and that she kind of got perturbed if you tried to expose too much. Am I right?
Well, she said our jobs were to remain stupid. You know, just basically, we want you to do this. We don't want you to ask questions. But just, yeah. And, mm-hmm. you gotta, what I learned doing intelligence, both later in Bosnia and this, is that you need that old bull sort of attitude. Because I've worked with young bulls who are a little bit excitable. Like when I broke the camera there, and the French mm-hmm. guy, Coop was his name, he couldn't handle the stress. Like, he couldn't handle, oh, my God, we blew the mission, blah, blah, blah. So what? <You know? laughs> But Paige was pretty, she was pretty hardcore, yeah. She was mm-hmm. She knew her job very well. She worked, it was actually an NSA mission. The operation was called Template. And I've heard of other NSA missions, and I don't have a whole lot of experience in this, after 6 years. But everything that I saw, all NSA operations for some reason started with a T. And I always wondered about that. I don't know, maybe if you ever talk to someone in the NSA, you can ask them. But there was Template, Tempest. They always started with a T in my experience.
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, also, in your book, you mentioned the fact that you were actually approached right in your room by a couple of CIA guys, and they pretty much just woke you up, and they wanted a debriefing on everything, and they pretty much told you that they knew everything that was going on. Am I right on that?
Yeah, the thing about Gander is it's such a small town. I don't know how many people. I would say there's not 2,000 people there. And so I got a call in the middle of the night. It's, and I thought they were RCMP calling me up. And they said, it was like 3 in the morning or something. So I was there in less than mm-hmm. 5 minutes. Like, I was still half asleep. And I went to their hotel room. And, they wanted to confirm things. You know, is it true that you saw this and didn't you about the flight plans and the whole operation? And I said, yeah. And then something kind of struck me funny, because they didn't say who they were. And then I said, you guys are RCMP. Like, why don't you call me during the day? I'm starting to wake up at this point. I said, and why don't you call my boss and tell him that you're going to talk to me? And then that's when they showed me they were CIA. And that's mm-hmm. when I said, mm-hmm. I thought I was working for NSA through the Canadian Army. Or am I working for CIA through the Canadian Army? And they said, whatever you want to put in your resume, go ahead. But, yeah, I confirmed the operation to them. And then I left. And then there was a panic. Because then my boss thought it's possible that they were Russian intelligence posing, and you just confirmed the operation to them. So I thought I was in a bit of trouble, but we did confirm later that they were CIA. So I wasn't a traitor that day.
Well, you know, it's amazing the fact that you as an enlisted man, and I have some knowledge of this myself because I was an enlisted man, that, you know, if you show a certain, let's say, entrepreneurial spirit or initiative, it's amazing what they'll get an enlisted man involved in, because, you know, they're just looking for somebody willing to take a little bit of risk and somebody who has a little bit of initiative.
Yeah, well, I had all the skills from the infantry, and I was in a very good unit and lots of training. And that's kind of the core, that if you get into trouble, you can always rely on that. But it's really thinking on your feet and, you know, just the ability to talk to people and think on your feet and talk to people is, it's more rare than you would think. A lot of people can't do it.
Right. And so, and there's a certain sense of fearlessness. And part of it is your sense of fearlessness. You're not afraid of a lot of things. From reading, you know, your book, it's obvious that you just kind of, whatever situation you're in, you feel fairly comfortable with because you're, you know, you've got a fairly strong sense of your own purpose and your own place, and you're okay with all this stuff.
Yeah, you know, even walking around Bosnia with a pistol and an M16, I knew that I was probably the best shot around. I've been on military shooting teams, and I'm just very confident. I can talk to people. I'm confident that I'll be good there, and if things get ugly, I got two weapons, so why not be confident?
Well, you know, that's. I wanted to talk a little bit about your experience with the Gander thing, because in fact, we've had Mary Fanning and we've had Claire Lopez on our program. We've had Alan Jones on our program, and they're talking about the Port Canaveral base that we turned over to the basically to the Middle Eastern company that is now the lessee on that. And we're really, really afraid of some of the things that are coming in through Port Canaveral. But in fact, when you were up in the Gander thing, they were overflying a lot of those areas. So they were getting an awful lot of the Russians, I mean, were getting an awful lot of information anyway just by overflight. And I think what the reason you're on the show tonight is that I want to kind of explain just exactly how strange sometimes our political processes, our security processes, and so forth, how strange they get because of all the political manipulation. And so with that, let's move on to Bosnia. I'd love to talk about your experience in Germany, where you captured that major general and the military exercise. I got a real kick out of that. But in any case, I would like to move on to Bosnia, because I'd like you to kind of explain a little bit of the history of Bosnia, and then talk about how NATO went in and some of the things, kind of lay out the pieces so that people understand that our so-called peacekeeping mission there was really different than what I think most people have been told.
Oh, yeah. It was different, as you can call an armed robbery peacekeeping. That would be about, that's probably an accurate analogy. The ancient history, and it's not so relevant now, I don't think, is that in 1389, the Ottoman Turks invaded south into a Slavic region of what's now, or was, Yugoslavia. And they gave the Orthodox, Christian Orthodox there, the choice to, well, they killed a lot of them outright, if you were any sort of intellectual or anything like that. But they gave a lot the choice of becoming a Muslim and living, or, you know, having your property stolen. There was nothing good. I mean, it was basically become a Muslim or die in a horrible mm-hmm. way. They stuck them on stakes with it. But so what I saw in Bosnia was basically a Slavic people, ethnically, genetically, they would be Slavs, but they practiced Muslim religion. So, but that is not that important, really, when it comes to what happened there. The two key things that happened, the blackest year, and no one will say this because it's not right, even Bosnians won't tell you this. In 1984, in February, they had the Olympics. Now, what I'm sort of putting together is that the Olympics are a curse. Look at Brazil. Your country goes mm-hmm. bankrupt trying to run these Olympics. So they were, the wall was coming down. I think the writing was on the wall. I mean, in the mid-80s, we were told that the wall was about to come down and over the next decade. And so we were sort of preparing for that with white papers. But so they got the Olympics. That was the first curse. And then right after the Olympics, in March of 1984, a man who I loved at the time, Ronald Reagan, but I loved his speeches and his rhetoric, but his follow-through was, now I view him as a mini Obama. He grew the government, grew the debt and everything. And he said that Yugoslavia should go into the sphere of international banking. And that was basically a declaration of war. So Reagan said, you guys are going to belong to the bankers and you're on short notice. And so what happened in the early 90s is that the international bankers, I mean, we like to say Americans or something when we're not American, but it isn't. I know what America is, and yeah, it's something to be proud of. But these bankers are nothing. They captured America, and now they're trying to capture right. Bosnia. And so what they
right.
did...
They're international bankers, and they're international banksters in truth. And
right.
They've controlled our Federal Reserve System as well as virtually every central bank around the world for the last 100 at least years.
Yeah, the old Rothschild, I mean, they were at the Battle of Waterloo.
Mm-hmm.
If you know that story.
Yeah, I sure do.
Right.
Yeah.
So anyway, they went over there, and Yugoslavia had this system, this economic system called the G17. It had nothing to do with the G8 we hear of. It's just within Yugoslavia. And it controlled, well, everything. It was a communist structure, so the state owned everything. So kind of like the structure is in the U.S. now, where the Federal Reserve heavily influences, like, the Teachers Association, you know, Soros, the media, Hollywood, all that. And so mm-hmm. what we did is, I shouldn't say we, but what the international bankers did was took control of that G17. Now, right after that happened, they took control of the banks and they recalled all loans. And almost immediately, and they also took control of all the media. And so 1,100 businesses in Yugoslavia went bankrupt overnight. Now, Yugoslavia is not like in America, but imagine even in America, if 1,100 mm-hmm. businesses went bankrupt overnight, it would be a disaster. Now, put it mm-hmm. to something, I don't know how big Yugoslavia is compared, maybe the size of Texas or something. Imagine 1,100 businesses in Texas going bankrupt, what those people would go through. So the people were absolutely destitute. Their standard of living their unemployment went up 60% at the same, pretty much overnight also. So we got these people very desperate by these banksters committing this act, made people directly. So what I'm trying to say is the army is not the most dangerous thing to a country. And, you know, if you read the Confessions of an Economic Hitman there by John Perkins,
mm-hmm.
he'll...
Mm-hmm.
tell you in much greater detail. No, I lost my train of thought.
Well, we were talking about the bankers and how they have really went in and overnight confiscated because they took over the entire banking system in Yugoslavia. And I was somewhat familiar with that, but fill up maybe some of the details.
Yeah. So the next step, after everybody is destitute, we own their money, we own the media, we have to tell people who to blame for this. And we also have the finance guys who are going to do our bidding. So these fairly popular politicians at the time were defunded. They didn't get a dime. And these lunatics who were ready to murder for money, basically, we funded their campaign. So you had Itzebegovich, the Muslim, who turned it out to be the biggest Muslim murderer of them all, Tudjman in Croatia, and Karadzic in for the Serb, the Bosnian mm-hmm. Serb entity. And of course they all pointed fingers at each other. And then Slovenia said, this is so the way the structure was that every country like Slovenia, Bosnia, all the various factions, they all had a vote, but Slovenia voted or wanted to leave. And there was a vote and the Slovenians won the vote. The commissioner committee, whatever it was called, they said, yes, you can leave peacefully. The Serbs tore up the constitution and said, you're not going anywhere. So they tried to attack Slovenia, but it just didn't work. Their logistics and they're all just massive, massive problems. So mm-hmm. they stopped. Then Bosnia did the same thing. Now Bosnia is right next door to Serbia and has a huge ethnic minority of Serbs. That wasn't going to work because it's not. There's no logistical problems there, and there's a lot of people. There were very few, if any, Serbs in Slovenia. So this is much hotter, and we let her fly, and there was mass murder. I mean, I forgot to put in one point back then. In the 40s when the Nazis were around.
Right.
They set up
the Croatians.
They set up mm-hmm. They set up the concentration camps for the Serbs. Mm-hmm. And it was actually run by Catholic priests, and they killed 600,000 Serbs, the Catholics. So that's why these Serbs mm-hmm. will never say they call themselves Orthodox. They don't call themselves Christian because they are Christian, but they look at Christians as Catholics or Catholics as Christians. Mm-hmm. And they say, you guys murdered 600,000. So there's also that. So they feel the Serbs felt invaded, murdered, and very paranoid and probably against the wrong people. They shouldn't have been paranoid against, the other ethnic factions, because until then they were all intermarrying and it was pretty seamless until we mm-hmm. made them desperate. It was mm-hmm. very sad to see. And then, so that's how the war started, how they did not start the war. It was bankers. I don't know how else to put it.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty straightforward. And I know a little bit of the history of the area because I know the Croatians were the ones that were pretty much not Nazi sympathizers. And I know that Marshal Tito was one of the Serbian partisans. And, he really gained his strength because of the fact that the Serbs were terrific guerrilla fighters during the war, and they gave the Germans an awfully bloody nose through their partisan effort. I know that. And I know that part of the conversation about Balkanization is because all these different ethnic groups, all these different political and religious groups, under Marshal Tito, when it was Yugoslavia, they actually got along fairly well. But it was because he was kind of a strong man, and he didn't put up with a whole lot of, let's say, laissez-faire activities, they, you know, he pretty much said this is the way it's going to be. And when all that fell apart, that's exactly where the term balkanization comes from, because all these different ethnic groups and all these different political things all came into play, and the banksters are there basically just raping and pillaging the whole financial system for the whole area, including all these Balkan countries. Now, that, am I right on that? And that maybe that leads into talking about maybe some of the mining activities and some of the natural resource things that were there.
Yeah, well, just to go on with that point, Tito was sort of a benevolent dictator. He was fairly fair. Mm-hmm. Like, he did have the hammer, but because, you know, he was a fair man, and people of all ethnicities there. I talked to him a lot, and I talked to, mm-hmm. you know, imams and police chiefs and all that cadre, and they all say, you know, the Tito days were good. You had to follow mm-hmm. the rules, but it was pretty good. Mm-hmm. So, but what kicked off that war was the Croatians. Tudjman ordered that all Serbs in Croatia were to be murdered. And in 84 hours later, they killed 2,000 people, and the rest were running in terror.
Hmm.
And so that's what sparked that war. And wow. And it's funny because Franjo Tudjman, there's footage of him going to do his first big rally back in Zagreb. And on the TV, it's absolute insanity. They're saying Tudjman is Christ, and Zagreb is Jerusalem. This is Christ returning to Jerusalem. And I mean, it's just, I don't know. It's just outside reality. And then of course, he orders the 2,000 dead Serbs mm-hmm. right away. And, you know, not very Christ-like, if you ask me.
No, that's for sure. Yeah. Well, and talk about what a wealthy natural resource area the former Yugoslavia and the Balkan states are, because, you know, the mining, I mentioned this to you yesterday on the phone, but a lot of the miners that came over and mined in Butte, Montana, and in southern Montana were from Serbia and Croatia, and it was because they had such a tremendous amount of mining activity there.
Yeah, well, I'll go on with the targets here. First, the first targets we hit was competitors with U.S. companies. So Philip Morris, the cigarette company, funded Clinton's campaign, and Tesla, or the little Yugo car, I don't know if you ever remember
yep.
seeing any
oh,
of those,
yeah. yep.
but they had a toehold in the U.S. for a bit. So the first wave of bombings, guess who? Yugo mm-hmm. and Philip Morris. So this was, but later, now I wasn't in the Kosovo charade, but they had a mine there at a place called the Trepča mine, and it was good for $5 billion a year of coal mining. And this guy, he's the former president of Finland. His name is Martti Ahtisaari, and he was to represent the UN with these negotiations. It was all a charade. I mean, all it was him going in like a goon. And he talked to Milosevic and said, we're going to take over Kosovo peacefully. And of course, Milosevic said, oh, no, you're not. And Ahtisaari said, and we are taking the Trepča mine. And it was, oh, no, you're not. And so Ahtisaari conferred with whatever friends, I assume they were bankers, and he went back to Milosevic and said, here's the deal. We take Trepča or we bomb Belgrade. We're going to flatten it. And there's going to be 500,000 people dead, and we're going to blame it on you. And Slobo never had this, I've watched him a lot. I've never met him or anything, but he's just very defiant. And I'm very surprised that he said, okay, you can have TREPCHA, and he gave it up. And the banks just walked in and said, okay, it's our mine. They called up all these companies that mine in the U.S. and said, we're parting it out or selling it or whatever at interest. So they stole property and sold it with interest.
Wow.
And they say that all wars are banker wars and all war is theft, is about theft. And the more I look into history through that lens, the more I agree.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, you talked about the 1,100 companies that went bankrupt too. Weren't they importing an awful lot of American and European products then into the former Yugoslavia, into those states? Basically, the locals were being forced to support foreign companies. Am I right on that?
Well, I'm not too familiar with that. I know that the plan was generally shut everything they got down. Anything that economically moves is done, unless the bankers control it, they'll restart. So, I mean, what they wanted to do with these targets is to bomb expensive things that on the other end would have to be rebuilt at a massive expense, meaning they're going to have to borrow money from the new bankers who just took over.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, these big complicated projects like hydro projects and these sorts of things, first on the list.
Mm-hmm.
And not because to deny the enemy the ability to have heat and light. It was about finances.
Wow. That's
yeah, it was,
that's pretty amazing. That's, it really is. Yeah.
Sinister.
Yeah, very sinister. Very sinister. All right. Now, let's talk about, and this is right at the top of my list, and I want to make sure we get this discussion done within the hour of our program. But tell us about your experiences with the Muslim population there in Bosnia, the relationship that you had with, the Muslim imams, and also the young lady that was your interpreter and others, and then explain how you were asked to, become basically an espionage agent with a young man who was a farm worker there who wanted to be an interpreter so that he could feed his family.
Yeah, that's a little emotional for me. I don't usually, but I will say that, so my translator was named Yasmina, and we did have, she was 19, I was 31, and we sort of had a big brother, little sister thing. So she told me far more things. She was the most intelligence I ever learned over there was from Yasmina, riding beside her. And because we had to go to all these meetings, sometimes it was for sometimes minor reasons, like the Czechs would spin their vehicle, their military vehicle, and take out part of the building, and they wanted compensation. So I would go up and negotiate that. It was a lot of these types of trips. But what we found is we found 40 Mujahideen plus a woman and a baby in the schoolhouse. And now this was sort of in the center of town, a little town called Goryevets. And we wanted to know, we were doing surveillance on it from, we were picking off signals coming from there, and they were going from Mujahideen to a Bosnian brigadier general. And so we knew there was a relationship there. They would come out at night and play soccer, thinking no one could see them. They would all huddle in the schoolhouse during the day, and they wore the red and white chamogs that they wear in Afghanistan. You're familiar with what that is?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. And we would do overflights with, I think we were still using the U-2 back then, the spy plane, if I'm right on that. But so we caught them. And what I didn't know was this is what we thought we found was very well known to the big brass beyond brigade. So we were in Northwest Bosnia, and we had a Canadian brigade boosted by Brits and Czechs, and there's 8,000 of us. But so we had that sort of intelligence at a local level. But the big guys, I'll just roll out the story here. And so we surrounded these guys at some point, and what I did was we were worried about Somalia sort of thing, where guns come out of everywhere and start shooting from it. So we needed to know if there were other people in the town that were being stored, like basically a can of tuna, and if we surrounded this schoolhouse, would there be soldiers coming out from behind us? So we were worried about the security of that. So we started human intelligence. We wanted someone from in the town to tell us who it was, where it was, where we should put our circle of steel. Should it be this? Can it be this close to the schoolhouse, or do we have to put it a mile out? Like, we're just trying to contain whoever's going to have weapons, basically. So eventually I got it out of them that all the people in these houses were all old people and children and women, because the men had already gone to the army, to the Bosnian Five Corps. So, okay, I got that information. And then we rolled into the schoolhouse. We surrounded it with steel. And they said, okay, we'll go. So the general showed up. And this guy shows up with the general, this Bosnian general. And he's wearing American fatigues with the American field hat with no markings at all. And he's wearing running shoes. And his hair is down past his collar. And as soon as he spoke, I knew he had that southern drawl from the southeast U.S., and they're the only people that have that. So I knew, I said, oh, he's CIA. So I was standing beside the executive officer. He's a light colonel. And he said, well, you got yourself in a bit of a pickle. I guess we'll go in and figure things out. So he walked into the schoolhouse with the Bosnian general. And, oh, it's all smiles and hugs going on in there. We can see through all the windows. And he walked out and said, okay, we got a deal. The bus will come tomorrow morning, Mercedes bus, and pick up just 10 of these guys, because we have to go, they have to take off from Croatia, from Zagreb, and they're afraid that the Croatians are just going to murder them as they cross the border, which they would have if they weren't with us. So it was all agreed, and we rolled in there with the Mercedes bus at, I forget, it was like 6 in the morning or something, and these 10 Mujahideen with the general got on the spookiest looking people I ever saw. I was struck with fear when I looked in the eyes of these people. They're just black, you know, pitch black eyes. Wow. And then they glared at me. But anyway, I'm having a little flashback here. So they got on the bus. All the windows are blacked out. We rolled up to the Croatian border, and the Croatian border police knew it was all arranged. Took off with their lights and siren. We followed them right onto the airport, awaiting Hercules C-130. It rolled right up to the back ramp, which was dropped, and we watched. I said it was half the Bosnian army get off. So the Mujahideen got off, got on the airplane, but then these other guys got off, and it was Bosnian Five Corps soldiers who had just stood down. We just stood down the Bosnian Five Corps, and we gave them an offer they couldn't refuse. All these young boys, you're in an environment of 60% unemployment. We got an idea. You want to fight for Allah? Your family will be safe. You don't have to do it here. You're still fighting for your cause. Come with us. And once you get on this database, you'll get a paycheck. So it's a payroll database. Mm-hmm. Now, database in Arabic is translated to Al-Qaeda, the base.
Mm-hmm.
So that these guys are Al-Qaeda. So like, just like I'm on the Al-Qaeda to be paid by the Canadian Army. It's not a strange word. And so these guys were getting off and we only saw them for a brief second as they went off the bus, and I wasn't allowed on the tarmac. I was at the fence. So, but my friend Mickey, he had a set of binoculars, and they were getting off the bus, full Bosnian rank on their uniforms and everything, right, and onto the airplane. And so my friend Mickey says, well, I don't know how the, it's a Mercedes bus. So he says, I don't know how they lost, how the Germans lost the war with magic buses like that. 10 get on, 50 get off. Mm-hmm. And the next, over the next 4 days, exact same thing happened. So what they were doing is they're collecting all these Bosnian soldiers coming to the schoolhouse, getting a few Mujahideen, and getting these Bosnian soldiers flown back, because these Mujahideen were flown into Bosnia when the war started to fight for the Muslims. They're flown in by the CIA, but there was no press or anything. It was very controlled. Mm-hmm. Now, or then, there was massive press everywhere in Bosnia. So we needed a good cover story to get them out. And it was
and they were flying out in American. They were flying out in American C-130s, right?
That's right. And they were flown, so they were to be flown to Switzerland, get on a passenger jet, and go to either Libya or Afghanistan for training. And then just as I was leaving, I think 3 days before I left, I learned that another pocket of Mujahideen was spotted. And I thought, yeah. I said, let me guess, 40 guys, and I confirmed this later, there's 40 guys again, which we discussed yesterday, 40 mm-hmm. is... You know, it's a Western platoon.
Platoon, like, yeah.
The Arabs don't fight in 40s. Yeah, the Arabs don't fight in 40s. We fight in 40s. So the number is kind of, it demonstrates what they're up to and who's behind it just by itself. But I thought, oh, yeah, here comes another 40 guys, and it's going to be four buses with 200 people. And so this was going on. And then I learned this Army intelligence captain eventually told me, this was right before I left too, he said, after I challenged everyone and told them it was a bunch of bullshit and I didn't want to work in the dark anymore, and mm-hmm. he said, mm-hmm. Bosnia is the biggest recruiting center on the planet for Al-Qaeda. And so I imagine all the problems that were, I don't know, like these guys would be 20 years in now. That was 20 years ago. So I don't know if you'd see any now in Syria, but I know that they were used as like a banker's foreign legion. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you want to attack Libya, well, you don't want U.S. body bags and Arabs killing Arabs. Well, that's been going on for centuries. So let's send these Arabs to take over Libya and take their gold or whatever we're going to do. And that's the way they were used, as a secret foreign legion.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. I mean, it really is. And the thing is, you saw it firsthand, and this Army captain was part of Army intelligence. I know you had a pretty thorough discussion with him, and he filled you in on a lot of the things that were going on in the area. Is there anything else you want to tell our listeners? But I think you couldn't have put it any better than the fact that the bankers were playing both sides. They were basically creating what we now know as Al-Qaeda. And, of course, I know that the term has been used, Al-Qaeda, for good reason. But the fact is that, you know, our own intelligence services were recruiting and helping to train these people, right?
Right. And the only reason I got this fuller picture, and you know, I'll never say that I have the full picture because you just won't. But with one of those Army captains' subordinates, I was in the Army with him in the infantry, so we had gone way back, and mm-hmm. and then we did this mission, and he saw my, you know, as I was getting information from the guy who lived in Goryabats, his name was Miloš,
mm-hmm.
and that. I started fearing for Milos's life, and it was sort of whitewashed, like, you'll be all right, they're all his relatives. They started, and it just didn't, and sometimes I would feel okay with it, and sometimes I wouldn't, and in the end, he was murdered in his backyard with his family watching, and mm-hmm. I didn't take that well.
The thing is, they had betrayed your trust because, in fact, they had asked you to develop a relationship with this guy, and they had assured you that, you know, one way or another, everything would be all right. And he ended up being killed, and you never did find out what happened to his family, did you?
No, I didn't.
I was
just beside myself, and it's what the one time my boss there, George, he was in the intelligence, and he was kind of my handler. He discussed which way everything was going to go on with, and I think he was as hurt by it as me, and he thought I deserved something, and so he filled me in, and that was the only reason. Is that that? And they were pretty much ready to take my weapon away. I thought, no, you guys said he's not going to die. He died, and someone's going to pay for this. And this is a free fire zone, this whole place. So I was very emotional. And these kids sat on my knee as I played chess with their dad. We were pretty close.
Right.
And I just knew the thing that really bugs me about that is that I, no matter what they told me, I knew that there was something not right here. I knew that he was going to pay for it. And I didn't understand, like, you know, these powers, they could have made him an American or a Canadian overnight.
Sure.
No chance. Sure. And they just chose not to, just to say, nah.
Well, and I think the one thing you came out of this whole experience, and it's, of course, one of the reasons I think that you became the head of the Canadian Libertarian Party, was the sense out of this whole experience, and believe me, all of us, I think, that have been in the Liberty Movement for a long time have come to this same sensibility, the same sense, and that is that we are only pawns, and that the bankers and a few powerful elite control everything, and they look at us as useless eaters, as people that are totally expendable, so that they can make a profit. And in fact, if it weren't for governments and all these damn politicians and the banksters, the people of the world could probably get along just fine.
It either changes or we don't survive. Decent people will not survive unless the system changes, and that's it. So this Trump is, I don't know how he had, maybe he has his flaws, but he is. To me, it's not about Trump. It's about the American people signaling that they want something different. And that's very important. If Trump doesn't work out, the American people are still there. And they still want that change. I'll tell you, only in America, no one clamors for freedom like the Americans, ever. And they still are, and I'm so proud of America for still insisting on that we have a constitution written a couple hundred years ago. Those are the rules for the government, and we're going to follow them. And if you don't follow them, your pardon?
No, I was going to say, and a recognition by some of us, and it certainly isn't all of us, because there's a lot of Americans that have fallen for this socialist nonsense, and they believe that socialism and communism is something that can actually work. But there are a number of us that recognize that government exists for the people, not the other way around. And I think the fact that Trump was elected was because, first of all, he was an outsider. And the globalists are in a panic right now because they see their whole house of cards falling apart because of one guy who happens to have nothing but contempt for, you know, the destruction of our country. He really is an American, I believe that.
Yeah, well, I certainly hope so. I want to believe it. I have my days when I do and my days when it's not so much, but Trump is outwitting them. So they have a big, dumb hammer, and the whole infrastructure of this massive system against him, and he's outsmarting them. That is just wonderful to see, no matter what you think of Trump.
Yeah. No, he has done a lot, and there's a lot that he can still be doing. But the fact that in a year's time, he has accomplished more of what he had on his agenda than I think most of us could even conceive.
Yeah, I say that, you know, he's basically, for the last year, he's run a 100-meter dash while under fire.
Yeah, definitely.
He has done something, but imagine what a real Trump government that could operate unfettered. Imagine what they could do because of his understanding of economics and business.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I think he does have contempt for the globalist. I really do. I think he really understands the banking system and what a fraudulent system it is, because he's had to work with it for his whole adult life, and he knows how to play the game.
Yeah, and I think the only reason Trump is not dead is because he can't be. For some reason, he's stopping it with some sort of system or structure, and I don't know what that is for certain. But he's already covered those bases too, which is the most important. If your life can be taken at any time, you have no integrity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So by covering that base, however he did that, it'd be interesting to know. That came first, is his own personal security. You know, they tried to kill Putin 4 times. That's what Putin says anyway. Trump, they haven't tried to kill him yet. And it surprises me. But I think there will be a revolution in America if Trump is, even if he's taken out what we call legally through impeachment, say the Democrats gain the House or something, it'll still be a revolution.
Yeah, I think so too, Dennis. I really do. Well, I hate to say this, but we're well beyond our time on this thing right now, and so we're going to have to call of the night. We want to thank our listeners for tuning in on the program. Dennis, I hope you will join me for another one of these shows later down the line. I really have enjoyed this conversation. And I thank you. Well, I thank you for your integrity and the fact that you are willing to tell the American people some of your experiences in Bosnia and when you were with the Canadian Army. And I really appreciate the fact that you saw this stuff firsthand. So it's not like you're saying something that you didn't witness with your own two eyes.
Yeah.
Dennis, tell us. Go ahead. Finish what you were saying.
I was just going to say that, I'm more of an American constitutionalist than half of America, basically. And I think if we lose the American Constitution as a lightning rod for a standard, a high standard of the relationship between the government and people, we've lost Europe. They don't think of the Constitution anymore. If we lose America, we're done. Even though I'm a Canadian, this is a very important fight for me.
Well, Dennis, I have to tell you, the three people now that I've met that are some of the strongest patriots that I've ever met in my 60-some years as being a human, Lord Christopher Monckton out of London, out of England, he's a Brit. He's part of the British royalty. Monarchy, I should say. Anyway, he's one, and Trevor Loudon is another. And both of these guys, Trevor's from New Zealand, Lord Monckton is from the UK, and you're from Canada. And the fact is, it takes people from another country to recognize what a gift God has given us through our founding fathers. And I just wish more Americans could appreciate exactly what we have and realize just how precious that gift is.
Yeah.
Well, Dennis, I
couldn't agree more, yeah.
Yeah, I want you to take just a minute to tell people about your book and then give them a way that they can purchase your book and get more information on you, and then we'll turn the show back over to Kelby. So just tell us quickly, how can they get your book, A Henchman's Honor, and how can they learn more about you?
Henchmanshonor.com, go there and you can purchase my book through there. It'll go through Amazon. And the book is, it's fairly dramatic, adventure-driven stories. It's not all fact-based until you start getting to the war. Now, I grew up as a very wild kid, wild times in the infantry, and I wrote about all the really weird things that have happened. And it culminated in this Bosnian War. And so what you see is a building of a kind of a soldier with a screw loose, I think mm-hmm. is really an accurate description. And then they give me big jobs. So it does get a little bit into, it's not an information heavy book. It's a dramatic read is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's easy to read. It's a very, very good. You once you pick it up, you want to read it. It's well written. I'm really surprised that you haven't written more, because it's very well done.
Well, this was, I had a burning thing inside me to tell this. This has to be told. Mm-hmm. You know, so on my website, I also have written blogs and video blogs where I talk about various subjects too. So,
What's your address on your various, that they can see some of your YouTube videos? Do you have an actual blog site or website that they can go to?
Yeah, it's ahenchmanshonor.com, and then it's just, you have various choices there. You can go to blogs or videos or purchase the book, but that's the website. It's all on there.
Okay, wonderful, wonderful. Well, Dennis, again, thank you for being our guest tonight, and I really appreciate your candor and your conversation, and I hope that you'll entertain the idea of coming back for another show sometime in the future. And with that, Kelby, I turn the show back over to you.
Thank you, Dennis. Thank you, Dan. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this week's call for Connecting the Dots with Dan Happel. God bless. Good night. We'll see you next Thursday, 6 p.m. Pacific. Bye-bye.